Good morning, everyone. If you would, open your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 13. We'll be there in a moment, but before we start the sermon, two announcements about Bible classes. So, accidentally, I forgot to unsend an automatic email containing your homework. Since we didn't meet last Sunday, I'm sure that email was a bit confusing. So, we are still scheduled to do Matthew 15 this coming Wednesday night in Bible class. If you want, there's still physical copies, but I can also resend the Matthew 15 email. For next Sunday Bible class, I'll be filling in for Jonathan. And in the congregational survey, feedback that I got was that people think some of the classes I give as sermons should be a Bible class. I have a sermon that I think fits that category, and I'm going to try giving it as a Bible class. I don't know how that's going to go, but I want to listen to what you guys have to say, and we're going to try it out. So that's what we'll be doing next Sunday. We'll be looking at Joel chapter 2. Joel chapter 2 is an interesting chapter of the Bible. It's really easy to misunderstand, but it's also really easy to clear up the misunderstandings. So we're going to look at pitfalls in understanding prophecy. That's what we're going to do next Sunday morning. Okay, end of announcements. Hebrews 13, 1 through 6. In Hebrews 13, 1 through 6, the author of Hebrews points out why it's important that we recognize the importance of God's presence in our life, especially for the sake of holy living. But it's important for other things too. In Hebrews chapter 13, 1 through 6, the author writes, "Let brotherly love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Remember those who are in prison, as though in prison with them, and those who are mistreated, since you are also in the body. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous. Keep your life free from the love of money, and be content with what you have, for he has said, 'I will never leave you or forsake you.' So we can confidently say, 'The Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?'" So in verses 5 and 6, he says, you don't need to have the love of money in your life because God's never going to leave you or forsake you. He's going to provide what you need. And not only do you not need to have the love of money, but also you can have confidence that whenever you are seeking to please God, but man is in the way, you can have confidence. The Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? That idea doesn't just apply to the love of money in the text. Understanding God is in our life emboldens us and empowers us to do everything he said in 1 through 6. In verse 4, he talks about the marriage bed being held in honor. You know what's an important way to make sure you walk in purity? Remembering that God is with you and sees everything you're doing. It's important to recognize he's watching. That's how he's going to judge. He knows everything we do. Verse 3 reminds me of what Jesus says in Matthew 25. When those who visited the sick and those in prison, who were they visiting? They were visiting Jesus. Knowing he is with us and we will see him as we serve emboldens us to do those things. Verse 3 is referring to Abraham when he accidentally was hospitable to God. Once again, God is in our life, in our everyday life, and we need to practice these things because we're in his presence. And then verse 1, letting brotherly love continue. Do we not love because he first loved us? So remembering God's presence is necessary for the Christian life. The problem is sometimes it's easy to forget. We get put in situations where we think that God isn't with us, and we fall. So for our lesson this morning, I want to look at Daniel chapters 1 and 3, and look at how Daniel and especially his friends were put in a situation where it'd be really easy to think that God isn't with them anymore, yet they held to their faith, and God proved he was still taking care of them. In Now, I think one mistake I often make when I read about Daniel and his friends is because they do so well, I forget how challenging the situation is. And because we, I don't know if you do that too, but if you do, when that happens, we really lose a lot of how much it can encourage us because we take for granted their faith. So as we're reading through this, I want to try to emphasize how this would have been a challenging situation. Not to discourage you, but rather how even in a difficult situation, you can still hold on to your faith, be pleasing to God, and He will take care of you. So in Daniel chapter 1, let's read verses 1 through 7. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Judea and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them in the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine the king drank, that they were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. So this is as towards the end of the southern kingdom, Judah has refused to repent, so God has started the captivity. This is what we call the first wave of the captivity of the southern kingdom. There's a total of three. And in the first wave, Nebuchadnezzar came, and after besieging Jerusalem, he raided the temple and took from it some of the youths from the noble and royal families, youths who would have been educated and used to royalty. And he takes them, puts them in his palace, and starts to train them and give them access to the king's food. Now, when you read that, that doesn't sound half bad. They just go to royalty in one kingdom to another. You know, in some ways, their physical situation might not have been that worse. In fact, it might have been even better, because now they're not just in Judah and Jerusalem, but they're in Babylon, where the most powerful kingdom in the whole world is. But even though their physical situation was pretty good, their spiritual one was very different. See, to kind of put it in context, what happened to them would be like if you got forcibly moved to a new country where there's no solid churches around for you to go visit, you're not allowed to take your Bible, and there's very few Christians, maybe just you and your family. You know, your living situation is still the same, but spiritually, it'd be very discouraging. It would have been even worse for them, because it wasn't just that there wasn't a good church to go to. Church, all of their worship was centered in Jerusalem. You offered sacrifices at the temple. The high priest, they worked at the temple. And sure, Jerusalem was in bad shape spiritually, but there sure would have been a lot more like-minded people in Jerusalem than there would have been in Babylon. Also, you worship, you had Passover in Jerusalem, you had all the other feasts in Jerusalem, you needed the temple for the Day of Atonement. Daniel and his three friends, they were cut off from all of that. So if you get moved forcibly to some place where there's not a good church, yeah, that'd be discouraging. But at least if you could find fruit of the vine and unleavened bread, you could still have the Lord's Supper. They had nothing, well, very little. So in a much greater sense, their physical difference would have made even more of a spiritual difference. They were in a lot of ways, in their minds, apart from God. And also they're young men eating at the table of a king. So you're away from home, you're at the king's table, you're away from the temple, and you know what? And when I was a young man, well, I'm still kind of a young man, You know what I would have thought? While I'm away, I can go and play. But that's not what they do. Even though they could have felt like they were very far away from God, in verse 8, but Daniel resolved himself that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Even though Daniel is far away from the land of God's people and his temple, he still understands that God is watching him. He still understands that God can see him. So what does he do? He resolves himself to not defile himself. Continuing on, therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward of the chief of the eunuchs, and said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. I think this is really encouraging. So Daniel is resolved that he would not defile himself. Now, when do you think Daniel developed this resolution to be pleasing to God? Do you think it started after he was away and temptation started coming? Or do you think it started sometime before? I would guess it started before. It could have been he had a reality check and he thought to himself, I need to get serious now or else I won't ever. That is possible, I guess. But most likely, he was probably resolved to be pleasing to God before he ever came to Babylon. And I think that's important for us. If we aren't resolved to appreciate God, to be aware of his presence and the need for us to be pleasing to him now, when it gets to a point in our life where we feel away from him, we're going to be extremely vulnerable. Because if we aren't ready to be resolved and to hold on to him when he feels close, why on earth would we be resolved to hold on to him when he feels far away? I mean, think about this: the reason why Nebuchadnezzar is ransacking Jerusalem. God said, I am done with you, Israel. I am leaving the temple, and I am sending you into captivity. God actually was leaving them. God said that himself in Ezekiel. So, think about how easy it would have just been to say, well, I guess when in Rome, be like the Romans, or when in Babylon, be like the Babylonians. God left me anyway. No, Daniel was too resolved to think that way. And also, as Daniel and his friends held fast to the Lord and stayed resolved, God honored that. But it's interesting how God honors it. You know, for me, when I think about God being in my life, sometimes I get really wishful thinking and equate that to mean, well, that means he's going to give me what I want. You know, if I was in Daniel in his friend's position, I would hope God sees me pleasing him in Babylon, so he's going to bring me out of there and take me back home. We know that was important to Daniel. He prayed and thought about the return from captivity a lot. But that's not how God manifested his presence in his life. The way God manifested his presence in the life of Daniel and his friends was allowed Daniel to stay in captivity and serve the king. That's not what my first choice would have been. But God empowered Daniel to glorify him and serve him, serve God, while he was there. Sometimes God taking care of us is not what we would first want it to be. Verse 17, as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them. And among all of them, none were found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all the kingdom. And Daniel was there into the first year of King Cyrus. So God shows that he is with them. Now, I don't know if they saw that in the moment of it happening. It mentions about how God gave them favor, about how God grants them wisdom and understanding. I don't know if that's something they knew in the moment or they saw later. But either way, God didn't give them everything they wanted, but he gave them everything they needed to be pleasing to him and to glorify him. When God showed his presence in their lives by showing these young Hebrew men have greater wisdom than all these magicians and enchanters, all these false, evil religions and false teachings and spiritualists, they had nothing on the living God. They didn't get to go home. They didn't get to get everything they wanted. They got something even better. They got to glorify God. Now, if only Daniel ended there. If only it ended for Daniel's 3 friends there. But it doesn't. They're in a difficult spiritual situation, okay physical situation, pretty good physical situation. They do the hard thing. They make a big fuss about their meals. God honors that. They're in good shape. But it doesn't last forever. Look at chapter 3. Chapter 3, verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come up to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar set up. And they stood before the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. The herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, the pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, and all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You know, something I've been kind of annoyed by, unfortunately, and wondered about this passage is, why is Daniel so redundant and detailed about the golden image? It's kind of frustrating to read. But I was thinking about it. You know what it forces you to do? His amount of detail forces you, in my opinion, to kind of feel the dread that Daniel's 3 friends would have felt. So this wasn't just something that they could just ignore, that some side project by King Nebuchadnezzar that was in the courtyard. No, this was a big deal. It was in their face. It was dramatic. Everybody was involved. That's why he names every single important person, every language, every nation. It would have been loud and dramatic. You had every instrument and more being involved, every kind of music. This was big, dramatic, and unavoidable. And can you just imagine how discouraging this would have been? You're Daniel's friends. God has blessed you. You're taken away from the land, but because of your faith, He takes care of you, and you think, yeah, I'm in good shape. I'm scot-free. And then Nebuchadnezzar creates this big old mess. That would have been horrible. I mean, it would have been easy to think, I've done the hard thing, now I'm good. It's not that easy. In fact, things are about to get even harder. Because before, their physical situation was pretty good. It was just a little bit awkward spiritually. Now their lives are in danger. Let's read verses 8 through 18. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down in worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, etc., to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall be immediately cast into the fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. As I was reading this text last night in preparation for my sermon this morning, I noticed something. In this chapter, they don't use their Hebrew names. Even Daniel, as he's writing about this in verse 16, uses the names given to them by the Babylonians. You know what that tells me? They have no control. They are so out of control. They are so stuck in enemy territory, they don't even have their Hebrew names anymore in the chapter. They are completely in the hands of the Babylonians, or it might seem that way. Here's something else that's interesting. Where's Daniel? We don't know where Daniel is. Now, one thing I do know is he's not worshiping this golden image. I think I can be confident about that. But he's nowhere to be seen here. And it was Daniel in chapter 1 who was the one who resolved himself to not defile himself. Now, I'm sure his friends were resolved too, but it seems that Daniel took initiative. So they're outside of the promised land. They're away from the temple. Things aren't easy peasy anymore. They have something even harder. They're surrounded and being accused by their enemies. The king who previously they thought was their friend is now ready to kill them. And their good friend Daniel is nowhere to be seen. It'd be really easy to feel like God has abandoned you in that moment. You know, sometimes God will put people in our lives to guide us, to help us, to encourage us. And God, I think, will sometimes use people like Daniel to help us know that he's with us. Think about how Isaac was assigned to Abraham and Sarah that he keeps his promises. And then what did God do? Offer Isaac. You know what God did to these guys? He took away Daniel. I don't know how or where. But the person whom I'm sure would have been a great encouragement to them was nowhere to be found. And they still had to stand on their own. Just imagine how easy it would have been to think that God had forsaken them. I'm not saying that's the way we should think, but it is a very easy way to think in a situation like that. But is that what they thought? They didn't think that at all. Even though many Jews would have thought God was far away in Jerusalem or not even there, in the midst of enemy territory, with the most powerful king of the whole wide world saying, "You obey me or die," they believe that God's hand is still long enough, his arm is still long enough to reach them and save them. I just love what they say in verse 17 and 18. "If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us up from the fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." It's one thing to resolve yourself not to eat unclean foods. That's a good thing. I'm not trying to say that wasn't good or impressive. But it's a whole nother thing to be willing to give up your life. Once again, chapter 1, good, impressive. But chapter 3, they weren't just willing to change their diets. They were willing to die. And that's not something that resolve alone is adequate for. You need to have hope in something that goes beyond death. Willpower is important. It's good to be dedicated. But you need to have hope that surpasses this life. Oftentimes in stories like this, you kind of wait till after God rescues them to talk about how God can save. But I think it's important. They've already proved by their statement in saying, "We will not bow down to that image," that they understand God has the power to save. In saying, "We will not bow down, we would rather die," they are teaching Nebuchadnezzar, whether he realizes it yet or not, that they know that God is with them and they have conquered death already. Because they knew God was in their life and they still had faith, they could say no. You know what's interesting? In verse 18, it's not that they're doubting whether or not God will save them. Verse 18 almost seems to contradict verse 17, where 17, yeah, he can rescue us, but if he doesn't, we still won't. It's actually confidence. They know whether God's going to save their souls or save their bodies, he's going to save them. They understand that he has a power over death. And that's interesting considering how little they actually knew about God and his promises. They had a lot of promises, but compared to what we know about heaven and they know about heaven, we have so much more. We can have at least the same amount of confidence as they had. Look at Hebrews chapter 2. In speaking of Jesus and his relationship with us, he talks about how we can rely on Jesus. The author of Hebrews talks about how we can rely on Jesus for his help. We're going to read 14 through 18. "Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through the fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. For surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. Because he has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted." We have so much greater promises than what Daniel's friends had. And with what they knew about God, they had conquered the fear of death. How much more should we be free of that fear? And it's not just the fear of death. Chances are, most if not all of us will not have to put our lives on the line for God But that's not the only way Jesus helps us. In verse 18, he says, "For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted." So whether you are being tempted to deny God or else give up your life, or being tempted to let go of your anger and lash out at somebody, Jesus is able to help you. How able do you think Jesus is? How compassionate do you think he is? It kind of makes sense to me. Why wouldn't an all-powerful God who is compassionate and hates sins, why wouldn't he help those who are serving him serve him? When Daniel wanted to stay pure at the table of the king, God helped with that. When, as we're going to see, Daniel's three friends refused to worship, God preserved them. God is able to help us in whatever temptation we face. Sometimes the devil wants us to believe that God isn't with us so we can rationalize and justify sin. Oh, God put me in this situation where it's really depressing, so I have to drink my sorrows away. Oh, God made me alone, so I need to satisfy myself with nasty things on the internet. Oh, God made me poor, so I have to steal just to get by. God's forsaken me, so I need to take matters in my own hands. Well, how able do you believe Jesus is to help you? Do you believe he's powerless, where even in a bad situation, he can't help you do right? See, when things are easy, it's easy to do the right thing because it doesn't come at too much of a cost. But whether it's our life or our comfort or maybe a bit of loneliness, are we willing to trust that God will help us in that situation? And that's the whole point of Hebrews 13, 6, 5 and 6. You don't need to love money because God's going to take care of you. Matthew chapter 6, verse 33, seek first the kingdom of heaven and all you need will be provided. In Romans chapter 12, Paul says you don't have to take vengeance because God's going to take vengeance. Paul writes that we can handle our bodies with self-control. God designed our bodies. He's not going to make his plan not work. And whatever other temptation you're facing, guess what? There's still no excuse to sin. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may endure it. When you are tempted, God is promising here, I'm faithful. I will provide a way of escape. Does he say he'll sometimes provide a way of escape? No. With the temptation, whenever you're tempted, he will provide a way of escape. So how faithful do you believe God is? See, that's why Satan wants to make you think that God isn't with you, because you're not going to believe he's given you a way out. You know what else believing God is with you? Not only does believing God to be with you takes away all the excuses we make to sin and destroys all the hypotheticals we might want to make, you know, you can also have confidence. You don't have to be scared of temptation. You don't have to be scared that God leaves you in the dark. He loves you. He's going to forgive you when you fail and help you succeed. And that's another thing the author of Hebrews mentioned in chapter 2. Jesus is constantly making petition for us. Now, how ridiculous would it be for God to want us to live righteous but then not help us and let us be put in situations where we have no choice but to sin? Let's finish Daniel. Daniel chapter 3. 19 to the end of the chapter. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it is usually heated. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks and their tunics, their hats and their other garments, and they were thrown in the fiery and the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed the men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of the fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yield up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king prompted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. It would have been so easy for them to say, "Well, everybody's bowing down. If we bow down, most people know it's fake and don't believe it, so we'd be fine too." They refused to compromise. They refused to make excuses and sin. With this temptation, God provided a way of escape, like he does with every temptation. God always provides a way of escape. And when they stood fast, they didn't learn that God was with them. They knew that the whole time. And it's kind of interesting. In the darkest moment, when their faith was tempted the most, that's when they were closest to God, in a physical sense, in a real sense. In verses 34 and 30, or 24 and 25, there is a fourth person with them. Now, that is either Jesus or the angel of the Lord. I don't know which it is. I'm sure everybody else has an opinion. But either way, it is evidence of God's presence with them. Now, once again, I'm sure when people think of God's presence with man, we normally think about heaven or the Garden of Eden, but it's also in the midst of the fiery furnace when it feels like God is furthest away, where he was the absolute closest to them. But you know who saw and realized God's presence was with them the most? Everybody who saw them be faithful. Up until this point, Nebuchadnezzar was real excited about his gods. But when Daniel's friends refused to compromise and refused to give up, and when they held fast to God being with them, that showed to everybody else as well that God was with them. So when we demonstrate our faith and we believe that God is with us and we act according to his word and trust in his promises, that will also show that God's presence is in our lives, so other people might join that. Last but not least, if you turn back to Hebrews 2, understanding God's presence in our life encourages us and empowers us to live holy, to never compromise. But we sometimes do compromise. It's horrible. We have no excuse to sin, ever. God provides a way out. Jesus is constantly helping us. Yet sometimes we still sin. The Bible's clear about that too. And yet, because of how much God loves us, not only did he offer his son, but in verse 17, Jesus became like his brothers in every respect so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. Jesus has offered himself and is in heaven right now petitioning on our behalf. See, knowing God's presence in my life and knowing how much he loves me not only gives me courage to serve him, but also the times that I fail, his presence gives me the courage to come before him, bring him my failings, and receive grace. See, I'm not ever tempted to hide my sins from God because he knows them all. Like, the only person I'd be fooling is myself. I have no doubts he wants to forgive me because he gave his son. And he hasn't struck me dead yet, so I still have an opportunity to repent. Sometimes we're hesitant to confess sins to people because we don't believe it's safe. We fear it'll do more harm than good, and unfortunately, that's sometimes true. There are some people we can't trust to confess to. But that's not the case with God. He is involved in my life, he is helping me, and he has proven that it's safe for me to admit I'm wrong. I don't need to defend myself. I don't need to justify myself. And I can't say, God, you weren't here. I know that doesn't work. I can know it's safe to come to him. So if you're a Christian and you're with us this morning and you've been doubting whether or not God's in your life, I'd like to encourage you, the brethren here would love to encourage you, to hold fast to God and believe his promises and resolve yourselves to do that. If you're not a Christian, God is near to you too, but he's not as close as you can be. Something else you're near to is judgment. You need to pick which one you want to dwell in your life. Do you want sin and death? Or do you want God who is wanting, not just willing, but wanting to forgive you and make you his child? If you want that, if you're willing to confess Jesus as Lord, if you believe God raised him from the dead, we have the waters of baptism ready now. If you need our help or God's help, please come forward while we sing the song of invitation.